Hello, and welcome to the Adventure Options Podcast. You want adventures and you have options. In this episode, I interview Chris Mackay, who is the co-founder of Crooked Trails. Crooked Trails is an NGO that is working to make tourism a positive force in the world. Stay tuned to hear how music and mud are both used to better people's lives. As always, this podcast is sponsored by Adventure Writers, copywriting for the travel industry. There are 4.6 billion web pages out there. Make sure yours stands out. Go to adventurewriters.agency for help. That's adventure, WRITERS.agency. Now for the show. Chris, welcome to the podcast.
Thanks. Happy to be here.
I'm really excited to talk to you. You are the first nonprofit that I will have talked to on this podcast. And I guess I should say you're the founder. You yourself are not the nonprofit.
This is true. I'm the founder and executive director of Crooked Trails.
I'm excited to talk about that, but let's rewind and go back to maybe your beginning. How do you get into the adventure travel industry?
Oh boy. I think the adventure part was just how my father raised me. And then the travel part was how my mother raised me. She brought me to India when I was 16, and I'll never forget it. I ended up going back to India when I was 21 to live for 3 months and loved it. And, but always been an adventurer and traveled a lot around Washington, Colorado, Western United States, having fun in the mountains and on the ocean. And, in grad school, I met my co-founder, Tammy Leland, my business partner. And we started a little adventure travel company in Washington State, just taking people around the outside. But we had always been international travelers. And after a big year-long trip that I took by myself with a backpack, I came back and I said, Tammy, you know, I think we should start this company, because I had seen what I thought was a lot of just irresponsible and disrespectful tourism. I didn't think people were doing it on purpose. I think they just didn't have a sense of maybe how they could do it better. And this was 25 years ago or something. And Tammy's like, I'm all up for that. She had written her master's on, you know, responsible tourism. I mean, that's what she studied in depth. And so we went to Thailand and spent some time in the Hill Tribe villages up north and started Crooked Trails then, back in 1998. So it was a lot of things that kind of came together from my past that brought me into Crooked Trails.
That's really great. Let's go back to your mom. Why India? Why did your mom take you to India?
Oh, that's a good question. I always tell people I think she just had a feather up her butt. You know, she my mom is fascinated by spirituality and culture and religion. And there was an individual named Harikam Baba, or known as Babaji, up in the Himalayas, foothills of India, or foothills of the Himalayas in India, I should say, and outside of a tiny town called Nainital. And she had a vision that she was supposed to go see him. And so she and my stepfather decided to go to India. And I was 16 and I was around. So they brought me with them. And that's where a lot of this started.
That is so fun. And how cool that your mom just has a vision or has a impression or whatever you want to call it and acted on it. I think that's really fun.
I think that some of that just intrepid willingness to go out and explore and is definitely instilled in me from her.
And so then the adventure side from your dad, what do you mean by that?
Well, dad's an athlete and dad loves the outdoors. And so I was brought up camping and, you know, and exploring. And I love athletics. I love all kinds of athletics, whether it's, you know, volleyball or kayaking in the San Juan Islands. So I've always just been athletic and outdoor adventurous. And so I like to kind of combine those when I travel. You know, I think about like trekking through Nepal. There's that real physical adventure aspect. But the Himalayas, just by, I think, the nature of what they are, they're very spiritual. And it's easy for me to blend those two things and travel.
That's really cool. What an awesome background. Now, were you raised in Washington State then?
Most of it. My folks did split, though, and dad stayed in Washington and mom was in Colorado. I spent a number of years in Colorado, and then they ended up moving to Santa Fe, and a couple years in Santa Fe, and I ended up graduating from Santa Fe High.
Okay. What part of Colorado?
Denver, Boulder area?
Yeah, I used to live in Broomfield.
Okay, you know it. So, yeah, so I actually
between Denver and Boulder, yeah.
If you're familiar with Colorado, down in the south, there's the Sangre de Cristo mountain range, you know, about 4 hours south of Denver on 285 is the beautiful San Luis Valley, and flanked by the San Juans on one side and the Sangre de Cristos on the other. And I ran down there in conjunction with my mother, a wilderness youth camp for Native American kids for, my gosh, 9 years, I think 9 summers. And we used to climb all throughout the Sangre de Cristo. So I love Colorado.
That's crazy. That's awesome. And how old were you when you were doing that?
I started when I was 18 and 19, and then went through into my early 20s when I was up here. And then I started getting a master's in environmental education and science from Western Washington University. And just because I love the outdoors and doing environmental ed. And then I ended up spending almost another 8 summers as a marine biology guide in the San Juan Islands. Loved that. So much fun.
You're not kidding when you say that you were raised in adventure travel. Like I'm listening to your stories and I just think this is what you were raised to do, was to be an adventure traveler. I think that's amazing.
I love it. It's funny though, you know, I spent my 20s and 30s definitely focused on adventure. But in my 40s and 50s now, it's a lot more on spirituality and service. You know, I feel like I just designed a trip for 10 women to go to Nepal, and they wanted to climb up to Annapurna Base Camp. And I'm like, absolutely, I can do that for you. But how about we throw in a little bit of meaning along the way? And I had them stop in and visit Mayati Nepal, which rescues girls from the brothels of India, girls that have been sold into those brothels, Nepali girls. And I've been supporting their work for about 15 years. Last time that I was in Mayati Nepal, I was doing a visit with Anuradha, the founder, and she brought me into this one room, and it was their music room. Music therapy is obviously a beautiful thing, and these girls have suffered tremendously. And I walked in, and they had maybe 10 instruments, and there were about 30, 40 kids in there, most of them playing air instruments. And I just looked at Anuradha, and I said, I know I can get you instruments. So when this group was going over, I said, you know, could you 10 women please go find instruments and bring them with you? And they all found 3 or 4, sometimes 5 instruments each. And they stopped and spent the day at Mighty Nepal, getting to know these girls, getting to understand more about human trafficking, which is a big part of what happens in Nepal. But most people just blaze right over it as they're heading for the mountains on their adventure. And so they had this experience. They also met with girls and groups that were working with Days for Girls, which works on issues of menstruation, which is a huge issue in Nepal, because when girls have their period, they can no longer go to school. And so they're addressing that issue. So I had this group of 10 women meet with these two organizations first. Then when they start the trek, now they're trekking with completely different understanding, a different viewpoint, a different heart, if you will. And they all just came back 2 days ago. And they're all like, how do we raise money for Mighty Nepal? How can we raise more awareness about what's going on over there? And so they loved the trek. It was meaningful and it was challenging and it was incredible. But what they're all talking about is the visits with the NGOs. And so I just feel like we can take adventure tourism a step further. Anybody heading off to Kenya, for example, to go on safari could easily stop in and meet with any dozen or more NGOs that are doing incredible work. Just a 2-hour visit, make a donation, raise your awareness. Same with Nepal. You know, stop in before you go off and trek. It's going to bring more meaning to your trip, and it's going to open the hearts of Nepalis as well to you, realizing that you're not just here to trek through their mountains and go away. You're here to understand some of the issues that they're facing.
You bring up a good point about how it can be very symbiotic, where yes, you're helping them and you might be donating things, but also they help you connect to the place and to the trip and to yourself deeper by understanding, you know, some of these things that other people around the world are going through. I think that's beautiful. So that brings up a good point of what it is exactly that you do to help these people, because I did read your article about the human trafficking, and obviously you're not going to take tourists over there to, you know, be Johns and go in and do these sting operations, because, you know, a lot of us aren't trained for that. So what exactly do you do to support it? Like, for example, the human trafficking one.
Right. So human trafficking is just kind of, it's an issue that I've taken to my heart. And so I figure out ways that I think I can make a difference. So with the trip to Mumbai, India, the article that you read on that, actually you probably understood from the article too, is I really struggled with it myself. I did not want to go over there and have this be a voyeuristic trip. I wanted it to be more meaningful, but I didn't want to just be looking. And the interesting thing was, is by nature of what we were doing, we were looking. And yeah, we were donating money, and that made a huge difference to these people. But in the end of the trip, and I think I made it clear in the article, I really realized that it wasn't just looking. It was more, fundamentally, I suppose it's looking, but when you get right into it, it's more like bearing witness to what's going on. And what I really recognized was, is the people who are at the forefront of the fight against human trafficking, or those who are survivors, and even the victims, actually really appreciate the idea that somebody's coming across the planet to address this issue, to meet with them, to hear their story, and to support them financially. So in a case like India, mainly what we did was listen to them. We heard their stories. We honored what they're doing. And they loved meeting us. Like when we met the girls that were born into brothels, they spent 2 days with us. And they were amazing. And they were so grateful. They said, I can't believe you came from the other side of the planet to visit us and to listen to us and to understand this issue from our point of view. And they were really blown away, and we had an incredible time with these girls. They were amazing. And we made a significant donation that allowed them to stay in their place for a couple more months. In the case of Nepal, what I do a lot of times there is I do have people, for example, like bringing the instruments or bringing other things that they might be able to donate. I'm leading another trip to Nepal on the human trafficking side. And next fall. And once again, what we'll do is kind of we'll go down to the border. We'll see where girls are trafficked across. We'll go to their centers and their rescue places and their prevention halls. We'll donate money. We'll support a theater show. You know, the girls have this incredible presentation that they do. And every time I've seen it like, I don't know, 3 or 4 times now. They'll do it in a remote village. And it's an incredible street theater that acts out the whole scenario of a young girl being trafficked. So we'll pay to have one of those put on. And so a lot of it is, once again, bearing witness and financial support. I mean, that's what they need a lot of.
But I like also that you bring up a point that I think maybe some of us don't think about very often, which is once they do get out of that situation, out of the human trafficking, then what? And that's where I think like the you know, music therapy you were talking about, all these other resources to help with the aftermath of the situation that these young women have been put in. I think that's beautiful that you recognize that it's not just getting out of the situation, it's recovering from that then for the rest of their lives kind of thing. So that's really, really powerful, I imagine.
It's actually huge. I do get a lot of people go, oh my God, I feel so sorry for these girls. I'm going to go over there and make a difference. And they're thinking that they're somehow going to help the girls like directly. And I'm like, you know, do you speak Nepali? Are you a psychologist? Are you a doctor? Are you a lawyer? Because that's what they need. They really do. The recovery period is huge. And I mean, these girls often have to serve up to 30 men a night. And they are recovering from multiple botched abortions. They are suffering from AIDS and other diseases. And the physical torture and mental torture that they go through is unbelievable. And in reality, I can't think of anybody I've ever brought over there that was capable of directly helping them. So it's kind of, how can we support? What can we do? About 2 years ago, one of the things that the girls do at Mighty Nepal is play basketball. And I thought, I'm going to reach out to the coach, the women's coach at University of Washington. And she went to Nepal and she offered some clinics to the girls. And we brought jerseys and basketballs. I mean, it was incredible.
That is beautiful. So do you find it hard to go from going into these experiences that, you know, are just really terrible to see and still, and this is going to maybe sound, I don't know how it's going to sound, but and still enjoy the trip. Do you know what I'm saying? How do you manage that?
You know, it's I think I've been doing it so long, it comes second nature to me that I'm, oh God, how to say it? I mean, it's easy for me to appreciate everything that's going on and to try not to judge it all really heavily, so that whatever comes, if it's a joyous moment, it's joyous. And if it's a painful moment, it's painful. And I just go from one to the next, and I don't drag them overlapping upon one another. And interestingly enough, I've found that a lot of the people that I bring somehow are managing that as well. And I think part of it is because when we go, we're often meeting with the people who are on the front of the fight, and they're telling us about successes and they're telling us about challenges, and they themselves are laughing and crying simultaneously. And you'll meet girls and they'll tell you some horrific story, but then the next moment, like, they're laughing and dancing and holding your hands and henning your hands, you know? And so they too, I think some of it has to do with just this, a Buddhist background or a Hindu background. Like, I don't know. They tend to just not cling to any particular thing, but just let all of it just flow over them. And so I've had a couple people say, Chris, I don't know if I could go on that trip because I think I would just be crying all the time. And I said, I promise you won't. There'll be times when you're laughing. There'll be times when you're smiling. There'll be times when you are crying. There'll be times when you're shocked. But if you can not attach yourself to any particular thing at any moment, then every time that it flips, you know, from sad to happy to atrocious to inspirational, and they're all there together, then you can manage it. You really can.
And really feel all of the feelings. That's really beautiful. So, not to change the subject dramatically.
Go ahead.
But let's do that. Let's talk about some of your other trips and other destinations and other things you do, because it's not all human trafficking.
No, it's such a small part. You know, I lead one trip, maybe two trips a year on that. But the majority of what Crooked Trails is trying to do, you know, back 20 years ago, I never heard anybody calling it this, and Tammy and I decided to call it community-based tourism. And our thought was always that let's get in touch with indigenous people in small rural areas and, like, hang out with them. Let's have a mini Peace Corps experience, if you will. And right from the get-go, we felt like tourism should not happen to people, that those people should be in control of the tourism that's going on. So, for example, if you went to Kenya with us and you're like, hey, I want to go check out that Maasai village called Marushi, I would give Kakuta a call and say, hey, these folks would like to come, you know, would you like to host them? I mean, it's in their hands. It's the same if you go into Vicos in Peru, beautiful, incredible little village, at, you know, 11,000 feet, and nobody goes in there. And you know, we get a hold of Pablo. And talk with them. So the idea is to go into these areas. And a lot of them are kind of rustic, so it might be a bit of an adventure to get there. like Choki Corral, for example. I mean, what an adventure that is. You know, I think Lonely Planet had it in the top 10 destinations last year, or was it this year, places to go. Kind of Machu Picchu's little sister, if you will. It's still being unearthed. It's incredible ruins. And it's a 2-day trek to get there. You can continue and trek another 5 days and get into Machu Picchu, which is a really neat back way to get into Machu Picchu instead of the 4-day Inca Trail that a million people are doing. You could come in from the back way and not see a soul. And so when we do that Choki Corral, for example, our guides are, it's Juan and his family, his brothers and his cousins. They live at the foot of Choki Corral. It's one of the villages on the way. And so we really want to try and put people in touch with locals who can be the guides and be their eyes and ears and their understanding to the adventure that's there and also to the culture.
That's beautiful. It reminds me of, like, when someone comes to visit me here in Portland, I take them around to all the fun things that I think that that specific person would want to see in the area. And so that's kind of what I'm envisioning when you're talking, is just going to meet a friend and having that friend show you the place that they live.
That's what we like to do, like with Cuba, you know, it's like, let's introduce you to Maurizio. He's going to show you around. He loves showing people around. It's just, he loves to talk about Cuba. He loves Cuba. He's not one of those people who's like, I want to get out of here. You know, he loves it there. And so it's fun to understand Cuban history and culture from his perspective. And I think that's just what makes it interesting when you get to another country, is to have a local guide and a local experience.
And so what are some of the things that you're doing in some of these other areas to help? Like, are you building houses? Are you digging wells? What are you doing in these areas?
So first, I don't consider us to be a volunteer tour organization. There definitely, we can arrange that at times, but what I really like is just putting people in touch with locals. And to me, in a way, that's service to them because they really benefit from the tourism. But there are some areas where we are involved in stuff. For example, Nepal, you know, we built this big school and the water system and a community center there, and a milk station. I mean, all these things that the community wanted. And so as people came over the years, we just kept building, you know, things because people wanted to be of service when they were there. In Peru, in Vicos, and in Umasbamba, we've been building smokeless ovens. That's kind of a neat project because a smokeless oven, you can build it in a day or two. It costs about $230. So you could go to Peru with us, and we could set you up for a couple days in a village, and you go do this project for them. You pay for it, and you get to build it. You get to work with the family because they're right there. And then you're off and running onto another thing, you know, to go off to see Machu Picchu or something. And so I really like that project there. I also decided I thought it would be fun to do, I started this about 2 years ago. I'm calling it the world through soccer. And just knowing that soccer is the world sport, I thought it'd be fun to build a soccer field in a different village or different country every year. So last year was Peru. In February next year, we're doing Kenya. And then I think in 2020, we're going to shoot for Colombia. I've never been to Colombia, so that'll be really fun.
That's a really great goal, to unite the world through play. I think that's beautiful. And I noticed some of the pictures on your family adventures had kids playing soccer on there. So why don't you talk a little bit about the family adventures that you offer?
Well, when I first started getting going with Cricket Trails, I just a couple years later, I had my own kid from a guy that I met in Nepal paragliding. He's Scottish. So my half Scottish daughter and I have traveled to Peru 4 times together. Actually, 5. She went with me on a soccer trip last year. So she went when she was 2, 4, 6, 8, and 14. And I just realized how much fun it was for her and how it opened her eyes to just different ways of living. But it was also a lot of fun to travel with your kid as an adult because they see things differently. They don't care about the history, right? They're just like, wow, look at these stones, right? They're just into the stone Inca ruins. You know, they're fascinated. They want to climb all over them. When we went to Machu Picchu, I had the parents all go with the guide to go learn about the history. But then I played hide and seek with the kids at Machu Picchu. I mean, what a fun place to play hide and go seek, I'll tell
wait,
you.
Wait, I want to play hide and seek. I don't want to go over with a guide. I want to be the one to play hide and seek.
I know. I had a couple parents tell me, can I go with you? You know, or like, as you probably know, I'm not sure, Shane, if you've been to Peru or not, but they, you know, they eat guinea pigs and they call them cuy, and it's just, you know, it's like chicken to them.
It's like rotisserie. I haven't been to Peru, but I lived in Ecuador, and same thing. It's like they're on like spigots, like rotisserie guinea pig. Yeah.
And they put like this little piece of fruit in its mouth, and the whole thing is there. This little feet. Oh my God.
Ears and all. Yep.
The whole thing. And so every family has their own little pen in the, you know, and sometimes in the living room if it's a, you know, a poor family in the mountains, but they all have these guinea pigs. And my daughter just, you know, like any kid, loves animals. And I have all these pictures over the years of her holding up these guinea pigs. And I remember 1 year she named one of them like Strawberry, I think, or Peaches. I think it was Peaches. And she's like, Mama, and she holds it up, please don't let him eat this one. You know, and it just was so, it's such a different perspective. Like that. To her, it was all about the animals. She loved the llamas and she loved the goats. And she was all over the animals. And in and out of mud, you know, and just, I mean, it was just this big, muddy, fun, wild adventure. We made mud bricks. That's why she was in the mud so much. And And she met my godchild there named Chaska, and she always asked about Chaska. How come Chaska doesn't speak our language, you know? Well, maybe you could try Spanish, because Spanish is her second language, Drin. You know, so it's just been, I think it's a lot of fun for kids. And so we just realized, too, that, you know, a lot of our trips, we like to focus in on families and villages and things. And so they want to see our kids, too. And so if you bring your families, it's just this one big giant adventure. And last year when we did the soccer trip, it was all families from the Seattle area. I think we had six of them. There were about 30 of us. And the kids had an awesome time, you know, just living in this mountain village, a lot of walking and a lot of hard work, getting the field all up and going. And then they played soccer with the locals, and they just had such a joy. And the locals love meeting our kids, you know, and so I think, especially something like Peru, it's a beautiful place for families. And going to like something like Kenya, oh my God, what a wonderful place to bring children, you know, like what kid doesn't want to see elephants and cheetahs and all these things and then hang out in a Maasai village? And I thought it'd be so much fun to have a program that taught, you know, young kids how to be warriors. And Kakuta, my Maasai friend's like, yeah, let's do a warrior training program. The kids would love it. They can make a spear and make a shield. And, you know, it's just a completely different perspective when you have kids.
Yes, it is. And I love that you are making it not just kid friendly, but some of the activities kid focused, where they themselves can connect to the area, not just that they're allowed to be there, but that it's actually for them to connect to the area and the people, and vice versa for the people to connect with them. I love it. Love it all.
Yeah. Cooking classes, you know, Cusco is a great chocolate making class. And one time I was there, I went to take it just to see if I thought kids would like it. Of course, I was surrounded by kids. I was like the only adult making the chocolate stuff. And I thought, this is fun. Parents should do this with them.
Right.
Sometimes I think we think there's things for kids that the parents want to do, and then we think there's things for parents that the kids want to do.
So true. Chris, I just think you have an amazing organization. Your trips look like they are not only fun, but with purpose and meaning. And I just think that's wonderful. I always like to end these interviews with two questions. And the first one is, where's your favorite place to go? And it can be one of your tours or, you know, one of the villages you've been to. And then leave us with a piece of advice for today's traveler. What would you tell today's traveler if you could only give them one like little nugget of advice?
All right. You know, it's funny. I've obviously traveled a lot in my life, and I do get people asking me a lot, where's your favorite country? And I realized after a while that my favorite place is always the one that I'm in. And like I just got back from Day of the Dead in Oaxaca, and just, you know, a month ago. And I thought, oh, this is it. This is my favorite place, you know. But just before that, I was in India. Like, oh my God, this is amazing. And when I was in Kenya, no, this is it. Kenya is my favorite place. And I realized I'm just, wherever I'm at, I'm so appreciative of what I'm seeing, and I'm so blown away and open to it all that I always say, oh, this is it. And I can't tell you how many times I have said, this is my favorite country, when it was a completely different country. But I will tell you, Nepal has a special place in my heart. I've spent a lot of time there, and I think maybe it's just the Himalayas too, you know, Bhutan, Northern India, those places are really, I'm a mountain girl in a lot of ways. I love ocean too, but there's something about it. And then a piece of advice I'd love to give too, you know, one is figure out a way to give back. I don't care if you're on a major tour, but it's easier than you think, you know, figure out what's meaningful to you, whatever that is, whether it's animals or homelessness or the environment or, you know, agriculture, I don't care. And then find an NGO working in the country that you're about to go to and reach out to them and ask if you can meet and make a donation and or volunteer your time and make a difference. Even if it's for 2 hours, do it. It will change your whole perspective on your trip. And then the second thing is, you know, travel plastic free. It's not that difficult. And we've required everybody traveling on our trips be prepared to clean their own water and carry a method to do it, like a Steri pen or something like that. It's easy to do. And it's just so important these days. So if people have questions, Crooked Trail started a campaign called Travelers Against Plastic. And it's travelersagainstplastic.org. You can go there, sign the pledge saying you're not going to use plastic water bottles. And it gives you lots of information on and ideas on things that you can purchase to avoid plastics while travel.
That's perfect. I will put a link to that in the show notes, as well as a link to crookedtrails.org. So you can go on there and check out everything that Chris is doing. Chris, that was beautiful, awesome piece of advice. And just the whole thing was just so fun to hear your stories. Thank you so much for coming on.
It was my pleasure. Thank you.
Shayna here. Wasn't that fascinating? It renewed my drive to have meaning and purpose in everything that I do, including travel. And that it's okay to feel all the feels when you travel, both sad and happy. Remember to subscribe to the podcast so you can be notified when a new episode airs. Until next time, goodbye.